Just remembering when I came in and sat down here in this very prominent position, how as a child I always wanted to be an actress. So I guess this is the sort of next best thing. So this afternoon, I chose the topic of touching the void for the talk. It's a bit of a crib. Some of you may know the story. Somebody told me this morning, in fact, that the person who wrote the book was taking the title from somewhere else. So I don't know where it came from originally, but it seemed like a very nice title. Particularly for looking at the subject of say, the mystical journey or spiritual practice, which is what some of us are heavily into, and others of you may be beginning to find an interest in, which has brought you here this afternoon for the talk. The story that I read was a mountaineering story about someone who fell off a mountain, basically. He already had a broken leg, and he fell off a mountain and found himself hanging in midair in the middle of a snowstorm with his friend hundreds of feet up above with absolutely no idea what had happened to him. And the friend cut the rope, imagining that this person wouldn't be surviving. And in fact, he did survive after an ordeal that lasted 4 or 5 days. He managed to get himself down the mountain with his broken leg and arrived just as his friend and the person at the base camp were about to leave. So it was a very remarkable story of survival and endurance. But perhaps the most significant aspect of it, which is really what I'd like for us all to reflect on, is that moment of just really not knowing what's going to happen next. Most of our lives, we actually are very heavily committed to trying to find some kind of security. We want to know what's going to happen next. We want security, we want some kind of certainty. When we're told that the only certainty is death, that's not really terribly reassuring because most of us don't really want to acknowledge that. Most of us would like something more certain, more permanent, more enduring about our existence, some kind of reassurance. That actually things are going to be all right forever, and this is how. So we tendency to invest lots of money, to have property, possessions, to find a place for ourselves in the world, some kind of role for ourselves, some kind of position that we can feel good about, that's acceptable. Relationships, friends, family. Good relationships with people. All these many different ways that we look for material security. And we really don't want to hear about death because that's actually very frightening for us, because that's the unknown. We don't know what's going to happen. And the idea of touching the void is absolutely terrifying. The idea of coming to a point where we really don't know, where there's no guarantee, no direction, no reassuring signposts or friends there to welcome us, to guide us. Just this sense of, you know, touching into the unknown. is something that for most people is really something we do anything we can to avoid. But when we really begin to contemplate our lives, we begin to look at life, we begin to see that actually all of this security that we try to create for ourselves is a complete illusion. It's not real. It looks real, it kind of feels fairly solid, it feels reliable. But if we really just think for one moment, things can change at any time. You know, the future is not certain. And so, for us, like for on a spiritual journey, like for those of us who have an aspiration towards really cultivating an appreciation of truth as it really is, it becomes a matter of urgency to begin to examine these facts of our existence and begin to come to terms with them. Fortunately, as Buddhists, the Buddha, he offered some very simple refuges. You know, having spoken for a few moments about the uncertainty of everything and how everything is shifting and changing, and even this very mortal existence that currently we're enjoying, or at least experiencing, this is uncertain. And over and over again we hear the teachings about impermanence. Over and over again the Buddha encourages us to contemplate impermanence, you know, as a matter of urgency. Yeah. Like form is impermanent, feelings are impermanent, perceptions are impermanent, mental formations are impermanent, sense consciousness is impermanent. You know, all of these things out of which we create a sense of who and what we are, they're all impermanent. There's nothing solid or lasting about any of it. We could say that they're all void, empty. The refuges that the Buddha offered were refuge in awareness, like the quality of Buddha, knowing, seeing clearly, this is how it is. And just that capacity to be fully, totally present with things as they are. This is something that we always have. This is a capacity that we have, something we can aspire to, something we can realize moment by moment, this refuge in Buddha. And as we practice, the more we practice, the more we experience the reality of this. And it's not just a nice idea. It's actually something that we can test out and that we can experience, this sense of presence, this quality of presence, of knowing, awareness. The refuge in Dhamma is the refuge that I find most exciting, actually. And it's the one that I see as being closest to this sense of the void, the unknown, the mystery, that which we can know right now, that we know through direct experience, direct awareness, direct presence. Again, not an idea, not a theory, not a list of qualities or nice, secure things that we can rest in and feel comfortable with, but again, just resting in presence and tasting it. Something I think I talked about last time, just tasting that quality of presence. That doesn't ask, that doesn't offer anything other than just a sense of ease in the presence, a sense of ease. And the third refuge in Sangha, the community of those who practice. Our own aspiration to live in accordance with what we know to be true. It sounds very, very simple, but because of the way that we've been conditioned to be always looking for certainty, it actually takes a little bit of doing. It takes a quality of faith, because none of us likes to not know. And none of us likes those moments when we just don't know what's going to happen next, or when we have to make a decision. I find decisions very difficult, and sometimes people come to me and they have this decision to make, and I can really empathize. You know, shall I do this or shall I do that? What would be the right thing to do? And it can be over, you know, really big things or fairly small, trivial things. We want to know, we want to find some certainty. And sometimes when we're caught in this kind of doubt, we can waver from one to the other. We can become quite agitated, you know, the mind getting very excited, trying to decide what to do. Looking for some kind of certainty. Many people find silence very uncomfortable. You know, if you're having a conversation with somebody and for a moment or two it goes quiet, that can be very, very uncomfortable, very difficult. And there are some people who seem to talk continuously. I'm amazed at how they can do it. They just talk and talk. And you know, sometimes I have a sense it's just because silence is so painful, so uncomfortable for them. Because it's a space of not knowing, a space of emptiness. You know, what's going to happen next? What am I going to say? Is everything all right? Am I all right? Are they all right? What's happening? Very uncomfortable. So we'll do anything we can to avoid this, to avoid the void. Sometimes people do it with activity. And last week I was talking about the problem that some people have of just having too much to do. And we were beginning to just look at, you know, how come we have so much to do? And sometimes we just have a lot to do because we can't bear to do nothing. It's too unpleasant. We can't bear the prospect that maybe we'll be bored. The uncertainty about the future. You know, so we've got something to do. We've got something. We can reassure ourselves. Oh, I'll do this. Rather than having to bear the feeling of nothing to do or not knowing what to do next. Or if we get sick, sometimes we can develop, you know, mysterious illnesses. I don't know what they are, don't know what's happening to us. You know, we feel a bit weak and faint, and maybe we've got a pain. Don't know what's happening. And, you know, when we don't know what's happening, the mind is very good at creating some kind of story. We can give ourselves the most wonderful diagnoses and have ourselves on our deathbed all in the space of about 30 seconds. go from having a pain to some terminal diagnosis to the end of our life. It just happens, you know, in a few mind moments. Because we can't bear not to know, so we fill in the storyline with something that seems possible, maybe not particularly comfortable, not particularly reassuring, but at least there's some future to look forward to. And then when we go to the doctor, maybe they say, "Well, I'm afraid we really don't know what's the matter," and you'll probably survive. And we can feel quite disappointed about that, because we were quite looking forward to our deathbed scene. Or we might be given a diagnosis. We might be given maybe something that is not particularly encouraging. It might be quite bad news. But it's amazing the number of people who actually find an unfortunate diagnosis much more bearable than not knowing. That empty feeling of don't know what's going to happen. Almost a relief to know, okay, well, you've got this, and this is what's likely to happen. But as we begin to practice, and as we continue our practice, gradually this changes. Gradually we become more at ease with not knowing. And if we're practicing correctly, I would say, we gradually attune ourselves or align ourselves with truth, with the reality of our existence. And rather than filling up our lives with all kinds of plans and agendas and imaginings about the future, we begin to be more comfortable with not knowing, with allowing things to unfold. When we take refuge in Dhamma, that's what we're doing. We're taking refuge in this knowing that's a kind of not knowing. Knowing this quality of presence, finding a sense of ease and fulfillment, completeness in this presence, without having to know what's going to happen next. Really making friends with the void. We begin to let go of the sense of who and what we are, which is an interesting one. And those of you who are familiar with the Buddhist teachings will know that there is suffering. This is something that the Buddha pointed to. We all experience suffering. And that suffering has a cause. And that one of the causes of suffering, well, there is one cause of suffering, which is desire. Desire for things to be otherwise, either to get something we like or to get rid of something we don't like. And thirdly, to exist. We want to be, we want to have a sense of who and what we are, our place in the scheme of things. We create a sense of self, a personality, who and what we are. And the Buddha described this as a cause of suffering, a cause of difficulty, which certainly has been my experience. Most of the suffering I experience in my life is about me, who I am, what I should be, how people see me, what they think of me, am I all right, this kind of thing. What am I going to do? What's okay to do? What's the right thing to do so that I'll be approved of? How can I maintain this sense of being okay? Or maybe it's a sense of, well, I think he might be a bit better than me. She's definitely not as good as me. But maybe she might be. And how that feels. This tendency to compare. I'll share a little teaching that the Buddha gave that I often often speak about, where he said, if you think that you're worse than somebody else, that's wrong view. Imagining that you're worse than somebody else. If you think that you're better than somebody else, that's wrong view too. And if you think you're the same as somebody else, that also is wrong view. Any sense of self at all is wrong view. If we believe in it, if we identify and cling to it as our identity. Sometimes when I'm giving instruction in meditation, I do an exercise with people, and we settle the mind, we sit quietly, and at a certain point I encourage people to just ask a question internally. The question, what am I? Or who am I? That's a question we can all ask right now. What am I? Who am I? It's a question that doesn't really need an answer, an intellectual answer, but which can take us to that place of emptiness, of not knowing. There's no intellectual answer to that question. When we ask that question with sincerity, from a quiet place in the heart, what we experience is just a sense of emptiness, space. We have a chance to actually experience what we are. The answer is right there in the experience. I realized fairly early on when I began to do this as a technique that I had to actually be quite careful who I did it with, because it can be very frightening. You know, just suddenly having to experience oneself as nothing at all. And I began to sense that it's something that, you know, you do have to do with a sense of taking responsibility. Because for people who have been very used to identifying, or have a rather a shaky sense of who and what they are, or identifying very strongly with that, or who are a little bit maybe not terribly stable and comfortable in themselves, it could be quite disorientating. However, when we have a strong sense of refuge and we're reasonably comfortable with who and what we are, it's actually very liberating. We begin to have a sense that we don't have to be anything at all, which is rather nice, actually. It may be something that we only glimpse momentarily. Certainly at first that can be the case. So much of our lives are filled up with thinking, a sort of continuous program of thinking going on in the mind, sort of commentary on who and what we are and how we're doing and what's happening and what we've got to do next, and what we should have done and what we should have said and what we're going to do and what we're going to say. All of this kind of stuff. But every now and again, all of that stops. And we have a chance just to be, to have that experience of being. Some years ago, I had an opportunity to go on pilgrimage in India to the Buddhist holy places. And I think one of the most important, the most wonderful things about pilgrimage is that a chance to actually stop, to drop all of one's roles, and to put oneself really on the line in some sense. It's always a little bit uncertain especially in India, you never quite know what's going to happen next. And having lived in community for a great many years, you know, I had a very definite position in the community. I was Sister Chandasiri, and people knew who I was, and there certain ways that people would relate to me, and I spent a long time, a lot of struggle establishing a position for me, and a sense of concern about the nuns' community having, you know, a position and sitting in a particular place, and, you know, being treated in a particular way, because, as you know, at the beginning there weren't nuns, and then there were a few of us who were there as, you know, very, very junior, rather a modest role we had, and as the years went by, a sense of interest in establishing more of a sense of equality between the male summoners and the female summoners, the men and the women who had gone forth. That was very important. Not so much at the beginning, interestingly enough. I didn't really mind. But then as time went by, there were times when it mattered very much to me. And so I certainly went through quite a lot of dukkha, quite a lot of suffering around this. And you know, over time, I'd actually was living in a way that I felt, you know, pretty good about, the way that the communities were evolving and our place in them. And then I went on pilgrimage. And it was just interesting to me how completely delicious it was to suddenly not be anybody at all. And I was traveling with a laywoman, somebody who's called Mei Chi. She's not the Thai word Mei Chi, it's a Chinese name. And she was somebody who I invited to go with me. And for a short part of the journey, her husband came to be with us, because we planned to walk. We wanted to do the walk that Mahapajapati did. She was the very first nun, the Buddha's aunt, his foster mother. And after she'd asked for the first time to be a nun, the Buddha had said, no, please, you know, don't ask that. And then he went to Vaishali, and she followed with 500 Sakyan women. They all cut their hair and put on robes and wandered for about 120 miles. It was quite a long walk. And I had thought, well, it'd be rather inspiring to do this walk, to walk in her footsteps to Vaishali. I was a little bit apprehensive, because quite a large part of the walk was going to be through Bihar, which is, those of you who know, quite a very, very poor and quite lawless state in northeastern India. And it's the place where Ajahn Sucitta almost met his end some years ago. He was robbed and ended up reciting mantras and offering his head, which fortunately the thieves declined, and they were obviously calmed and helped just by his composure, his collectedness, and he was he escaped narrowly, I have to say. So we were going to be walking through this area. But I somehow or other had a very strong faith that we would be protected. And anyway, Arvo, Michi's husband, had come along to be our guardian protector. So we set off from Kapilavastu, which is the site where the ancient city would have been, where Mahapajapati would have set out from on her walk. And we had a very, very cheerful farewell. There was a very tiny Sri Lankan monk who was absolutely delighted, highly amused at our undertaking. And we set off very early in the morning. It was still dark. And he chanted a load of protective chants and tied thread on our wrists, holy thread, and told us, gave us a suggestion about where we should, you know, the direction we should go in. I can't actually remember the name of the town. It was quite a small town, And he knew the head of the police department there very, very well, whose name I've also forgotten, but never mind. So we set off to this town on the first stage of our journey. We had sleeping bags. I think we had bivy bags as well, and mosquito nets. So if necessary, we could camp out. But we were hoping that we would arrive at this town and we would be looked after by the chief of police there. And we set off with great enthusiasm. And it was a long walk. And we walked and walked. And Arvo was kind of being the he-man, and at one point he decided to carry both our packs. He had a long stick, and so he had one pack hanging off one end, another at the other end, and his own pack in the middle, and he was feeling very kind of he-man-ish, walking along, looking after us, protecting the two of us on our walk. And we walked and walked, and along the way, people would really look at us. In India, people, they like to look at you. And they're not kind of bashful like British people who kind of, you know. In Britain, when I walk along the street, people don't look at me until afterwards. They always turn around and have a look after I've gone past, but they're very good at pretending I'm completely nothing out of the ordinary at all. And then after I've gone past, they kind of have a look and sort of nudge their friend and say, "Did you see that?" But in India, they have none of these inhibitions. Those of you who have travelled there will know. I mean, they just look at you. They just stare. You know, because they're interested. It's not a hostile look. It's not a particularly friendly look either. It's just a look. You know, because they haven't seen anything quite like this, and they're curious. And so whenever we'd stop for a cup of tea or something, people would stop and they'd look. And sometimes they'd come and talk to us, ask us where we're going, what we're doing. And that was all right. And anyway, it was getting towards dark. And, you know, we'd been walking all day. We were quite tired. Arvo's feet were beginning to blister. His shoes weren't very... They were just ordinary leather shoes. And he was beginning to have quite a bit of trouble with his feet. But I was just incredibly sort of enthusiastic, so I kind of set the pace. And I was reciting mantras in my heart, actually. This lovely mantra, Buddho Susudo Karuna Mahanawa, like the Buddha, absolutely pure with ocean-like compassion. You know, these incredibly inspiring words were sort of carrying me along as we walked. And Mechi was struggling a bit to keep up, and Arvo was definitely struggling with his sore feet. And by this time, we'd all taken back our packs, and we were in a slightly more sober mood. And eventually, at dusk, we walked into the town that we were heading for and asked where the police station was, and were told. Arrived at the police station. Yeah, phew, we got here just as it was getting dark. And asked if we could see the chief of police, whose name, as I said, I've forgotten. I remembered it then, but we've forgotten. I've forgotten now. And they said, "Oh, he's away. He's gone away for 3 days." And so we were a little bit taken aback, not quite sure what to do next. I thought, well, maybe there's a guest house. No, no hotel, no guest house. Maybe we can stay in the police station. Well, that wasn't really an issue, that wasn't really a question. And then the lights failed. In India, the lights are always failing. There's a power cut. And all the lights went out. And it was one of those very interesting moments for me where a real sense of just not knowing. You know, what was going to happen? What were we going to do? Arvo, by this time, could hardly walk. He could hardly take another step. The police inspector, who we really, really, really been relying on, much more than I realized, wasn't there. And nobody else seemed to know what to do with us. And so you know, having been practicing for some time, I thought, well, I'll just rest in the void, rest in the not knowing. So we sat out on a step, and the sort of quiet sort of discussion going on inside among the police officers, we couldn't understand any of it, but they obviously realized our predicament and just waited. And the stars came out and the moon rose. It was a very beautiful evening. Sort of night sounds beginning. It was a very quiet, restful place in the heart, in the place of not knowing. Didn't have any idea of, you know, you stupid fool, what have you done, what have you landed them in. That somehow that just didn't arise. And maybe I was too tired, I don't know, but it seemed to be a completely fruitless line of thinking to get into. And just much more, you know, being with the breath, being with the body, sitting outside, waiting to see what would happen next. And eventually somebody came along and said, well, you can stay with my friend or my brother, I forget who it was. And they took us to this house, obviously one of the better houses in the town, this man who was obviously quite wealthy, who had three wives, which was interesting, three wives and lots of children. And they put us up for the night, and Arvo's feet were completely covered with blisters. And so they had the perfect remedy. They said, okay, don't worry. And they put oil all over them, and then they put salt. And he had to kind of cook them in front of an electric fire. They said, it'll be perfectly all right in the morning. No problem. Very reassuring. So we spent the night there. And the next day, Mei-Chi had a very bad chest cold, and she was quite unwell. And it was clear that our walk to Vaishali was not going to happen in the way that I expected. And again, this sense of not knowing what to do. And I really, fortunately, I mean, maybe it's something about India. I mean, there's something very wonderful about India. You might so far have a rather unfortunate impression, but there is something very wonderful. It's almost as though the whole atmosphere of the place is kind of steeped in Dhamma. Sort of, one feels held there in some way. And so although the future was incredibly uncertain, what I found was just a real sense of ease in not knowing, and a kind of a patience and a curiosity just to see things gradually come into focus. You know, gradually it became clear what we needed to do. And just like with the Polaroid photos. I don't know if they have them nowadays. So you have a completely blank, it's completely black to start with. You take this photograph and it's completely black, and then you peel off a piece of paper and it's still completely black. And then as you look at it, a form begins to appear. And it was very much like that, just sort of gradually watching the plan take shape, you know, gradually getting a sense of, well, this is what we'll do. And it turned out beautifully, very well. We were able to travel to Kushinagar and spent about 10 days there. And I had some retreat time, and Mei-Chi and Arvo recovered, and we continued our journey. There were many times like that on pilgrimage. It's a really exciting sense of being tumbling into a situation where one really just didn't have a clue what was going to happen next. And where, you know, 20 years ago I would have been in a major panic, you know, really frantic, trying to kind of create, to find some kind of certainty. But after a little bit of practice, just a sense of really trusting that quality of awareness that can allow us to rest in the void, to allow us to rest in the place of not knowing, and to allow the future just to unfold in its own way. more and more I've come to trust that, and to trust it much more than my clever thinking mind. And I'm very good at planning and thinking about things too. I mean, people have commented on how good I am at making plans. You know, I can sort of have a whole month all planned out, you know, what's going to happen, and I can work out what has to fit in, you know, and how to arrange the appointments and different things like that. My mind does that very easily. And it does have its usefulness, like living in community, living with other people. It's very, very helpful to be able to do that. But I know much better than to hold on to that too tightly, and to be too fixed about my about the future. Sometimes things happen and things just have to be done differently. So what I'm suggesting is a complete shift in the way that we live our lives. So I'm not saying that we abandon our plans or our ideas about things, throw away our roles, our positions in society, in relationship, in our place of work or whatever, but more that we can hold these things very lightly. Like in the Buddha's words of loving kindness, it talks about not holding to fixed views. So we may have a fixed view about something, but we don't hold to it. You know, we just see that this is just a view. It can be very frustrating for people. Like sometimes people will come to me and tell me about something that's happened or something that should happen, and I say, well, that's just your point of view. They don't like that at all. Because for them, it's their point of view and it's right. You know, we all have a sense of, you know, this is the right point of view. This is how things are. You know, how I see it is correct. Yeah. This is how I experience it. This is right. But when we talk about things from the point of view of Dhamma, we see, well, that's just one view. Just one viewpoint. That's all it is. You know, maybe it accords with reality, maybe it doesn't. It's just a view, just a point of view. So we have our views, but we see them as views. We understand that that's what they are. We have our strategies, but we see them as strategies, not things to be clung to. They have their usefulness, but they can also very, very seriously impede us in our lives. They can block us, they can block the flow of Dhamma in quite horrible ways. In our relationships, rather than meeting one another afresh, you know, each moment, allowing one another to change and to grow, we can see each other in a very fixed way. We can see ourselves in a very fixed way, which can be completely stifling. I mean, those of you who've, well, I mean, I expect you've all had an experience of this. There may be parents who refuse to let you grow up, you know, continue to relate to you as their little boy or little girl, refuse to allow you to evolve, to change, to grow, to have your own resources. You know, often when you know, people, maybe if you have friends or people who come and tell you problems. I mean, I receive a lot of people talk to me a lot about difficulties they have, or you know, they want advice about practice or about how to deal with things, and if I hold to the position of being somebody who's wise or who knows everything, which is maybe what they would like. I do them a great disservice. You know, if I tell people exactly what they should do, and then they sort of feel satisfied, okay, I'll go and do this. That's what Sister Chandasiri said I should do, therefore I'll do it. And if I kind of feel that that it's up to me to do that, that's a little bit unfortunate. Because really, each one of us has the capacity to know what to do. You know, each one of us knows better than anybody else, actually. And what we all of us need is confidence. You know, the encouragement to trust in the refuge, the encouragement to enter into Dhamma, to touch into that void, to allow ourselves not to know, in order to find the answer, to allow the answer to arise for us. It's extraordinary how it happens. You know, if we can really allow ourselves not to know, to let go of all the things that we cling on to as support, as safety, and just allow ourselves that resting in not knowing, to trust that, then the chances are that we'll find a way forward that is much more exciting and wonderful. Things work out much better than if we just hold on to our fixed view, our limited, narrow strategies that we've evolved for ourselves. So I'm very happy when, you know, I'm quite happy to speak with people and to share if people have questions about practice and so on. But what you'll find that I'll tend to do mostly is, rather than saying, well, you've got to do this, this and this, I'll say something like, well, you know, trust your own intuition, you know, find out for yourself. Encouraging people to really trust that refuge and trust in the Dhamma. And that's what I trust in as much as possible. Sometimes I don't quite manage it. It's like a growing relationship, learning how to trust. But unless we try, unless we test it out, we'll never develop very much trust. It does require a bit of a leap of faith. In Christian mysticism, they talk about just leaping into the abyss, just taking that step into the unknown. Actually, that's what we're doing all the time. We don't know. We just think we know. But to be able to do that consciously transforms our life from being something rather terrifying and tentative into something that's really quite thrilling, quite exciting. You know, trusting that we have the resources to know how to respond to whatever life presents us with. It was interesting coming back from India from my pilgrimage. As I told you, I struggled so hard to have a position. And I remember the days just before returning to the community, a real sense of sadness at the prospect of having to come back to being Sister Chandasiri. None, having this position in community. Because there was something so pleasant about just being another blob among millions and millions of people on the subcontinent of India. Just a human being, like all of us, flesh and blood human being, with a body that's fragile, that can be damaged, harmed at any time, that is going to perish at some time, don't know when, but sometime it's going to stop breathing and begin to rot. there was something very, very peaceful, very comfortable about just being a being. But in our lives as human beings, living in society, of course, we have relationships. Of course, people are going to have expectations of us. Of course, we're going to have expectations of ourselves, positions, roles, duties, responsibilities. And there's nothing wrong with any of that. But it's how we hold it. You know, can we hold it lightly? Can we carry it lightly? Can we more and more touch the void, touch into that place of emptiness, which is our true identity, our real home, our real place of refuge and security? And this is the path of transformation that we're on. Gradually transforming ourselves from being a somebody, being a person, surrounding ourselves with certainties, I put that in inverted commas, surrounding ourselves with certainties, with securities, gradual, gentle process of transformation to being nobody, going nowhere, having nothing, and yet being utterly full, content, at ease with that. The fullness, the blessing of a perfect one, the Buddha, the Arahants. This is something that we can all aspire to. And just practice patience. Takes a bit of time, takes a bit of effort. But I'd suggest it's incredibly worthwhile. It can take us to the place of perfect freedom, perfect liberation. And it's like realizing our potential as human beings. Kind of feel it's come to an end now, the formal part of the talk. Last week the tea things appeared at about 10:02, so I stopped then. This time they haven't quite appeared. I'd be happy to answer a question in the meantime, if there's anything anybody would like to ask. And then we can have a cup of tea when the tea comes, and then we can have some more questions if people would like to stay around and talk some more. Is there anything, a quickie for now, or shall we have a tea break? Yes. So there's a lovely question here of somebody asking for suggestions for how to practice in order to develop this capacity to touch the void. Is that sort of, yeah. my sense is that I'd like to suggest just something quite short, so quick and simple, which is actually just allowing yourself not to know what's going to happen next. And to really delight in that. You know, to notice that tendency of the mind to try and fill up a future, to try to create a future with certainty, and to allow yourself to not know. Also, I make use of delays, or times when I'm kept waiting. That's a very good time. You've arranged to meet somebody, they haven't turned up. You don't know what's happened. Just to try to stay with that not knowing what's happened. To try to kind of rest on that point of not knowing, and to notice the tendency of the mind to come up with some explanation, or to feel irritated or frustrated, and just to try to hold with not knowing, that uncertainty. So to really welcome those opportunities, like if the plane is an hour late, just to say, okay, here's an hour in which to not know what to do, to just be present with this moment. those kind of things. So it's the everyday things that are the most useful, or can be.